Tonight on Arena, the new INO Madama Butterfly, Kevin Rowland on Finding Fame and Losing It All, and Folklore, Faith and Frailty in Saltwash. You can text us as usual on 51551, email us arena@rte.ie, and we're on Instagram as well at @RTE_arena. To start us tonight, one of the 80s most iconic singer-songwriters and Dexys Midnight Runners frontman Kevin Rowland writes with remarkable honesty in his new memoir, Bless Me Father, A Life Story. In a few minutes' time, I'll be talking with Kevin, but first, a little of this. See that dream, that's keep that dream. In the early 1980s, singer-songwriter Kevin Rowland achieved huge fame in the UK, here and beyond, with Dexys Midnight Runners. Number one hits and sold-out tours suggested even bigger things to come, but bad luck and worse management led to the band's implosion and a period of personal turmoil for Kevin. In his remarkably honest memoir, Bless Me Father, Kevin talks about his strong Irish roots, addiction, anxiety and the perils of fame. And Kevin Rowland joins me now on Arena. Welcome to the programme, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Pleasure. Tell me, let's start at the beginning. How important was that Irish culture and that Irish identity to you when you were growing up?
It's hard to know because it's the only one I had, you know. I loved coming home to Ireland, you know. That's what I know. I mean, I lived in Ireland from the age of 1 to 4. I started school there. Just before my 5th birthday, we went to live in Wolverhampton, and it was very different from Cross Molina in County Mayo. Very different. It was industrial. It was dark. You know, it was rough. Very different. And we didn't go back for about 5 years. So when I was 10 years old, we went back. And that was, it just always felt like home, you know.
Do you remember anything from those first few years in Cross Molina, do the memories that you have, are they ones from going back on holidays when you were a little bit older?
No, I do remember. I remember playing on the park, you know, there was like a green in the middle of the street. I remember playing on there. I remember starting school there. I remember getting a haircut there. Yeah, I remember it well.
When you stopped on the way back on the way, was that 1964, that holiday? Because you talk about it in the book. You stopped off and ended up in O'Connell Street.
Exactly, exactly. We ended up in O'Connell Street. My mum took me to the post office and showed me the bullet holes, you know, from 1916. Yeah.
And what was that Irish community like in Wolverhampton? Or was there an Irish community when you were growing up?
There was, definitely. I remember, I talk about it in the book. You know, I've been like being in a church social event, and everybody just sitting around drinking and playing records. And the song Kevin Barry came on, and my mum said to me, "It's illegal to play this song in England." And I was like, "What? How can a song be illegal?" And I said, "Why?" She said, "Oh, it's because of what the English did to the Irish." And I was like, "Wow." So yeah, there was a community.
Your dad wasn't necessarily so keen, though, on that part of your identity, was he?
He wasn't. No, you've certainly read the book, I see, yeah. Yeah, he was ambivalent about it. And I understand it in a way because obviously, the Irish community were largely pretty poor in those days, you know, in the 1950s and 1960s, just arriving, you know. And, so he was, and I asked him about 10 years ago, well, 10 years before he died, I said, like, "Dad, why were we always a bit separate from the Irish community? We were never really a part of it. I mean, you wanted us to be Irish, but at the same time, you were separate." And he just said, "There was an awful lot of drink in it." And I guess it's true.
The Catholic Church was a presence in your childhood as well, wasn't it? Were you an altar boy and you kind of toyed with the idea of the priesthood at one stage?
Yeah, I was an altar boy, and one day they sent a form around, you know, if anybody had the calling, a vocation, you know. And I think I kind of convinced myself that I had the calling. I fancied the boarding school, really, getting out of the house, because it was a very strict house, you know. So, I pursued that for a while. I had the Latin lessons on the Saturday mornings, and I had the interview with the bishop, and I sat the exam. But I was simultaneously, I was always getting, I was also getting in trouble at school, you know, so I think that's what kept me out of the priest college. I didn't pass the exam, or I got told I wasn't going to be accepted into the college, because you went off at 11 in those days, as you probably know, you know.
You talk about it in the book, about that whole period of you being a teenager and things going a bit off the rails for you at that stage. Why do you think that was?
Man, I don't know. You know, is it nature? Is it nurture? You just don't know, do you? I don't know. I think I had a lot of frustration in me. I think my old man was so strict, and he was so kind of controlling, that in the end, I just felt school wasn't... Anything I was doing wasn't for me, it was just for him, you know. And I just wanted to get him off my back, really. And I kind of, you know, I lost the joy of learning, really. Apart from writing, you know, I just felt I could express myself with that. But I wasn't interested in school, because it didn't seem for me, it was just for Dad. And I think I was very frustrated, you know. As part of my program of recovery from cocaine addiction, I went back to see some people, from friends of mine from those years. And one of them said, man, you were so angry. He said, your eyes would go black. He said, you would just be so angry when you're going to have a fight or something, you know.
At what stage does music come along for you in your life? Is there a light bulb moment at which you go, oh, hang on, this might be for me?
Well, I thought it was always for me, because it was the one thing that I really liked from being a kid, you know, from the youngest of age. Well, not the one thing, clothes and music and appearances I loved, you know, I was just excited by those things. But I can't blame my dad, but he certainly said to me, you're interested in the wrong things. Those things are not good. They're frivolous, you know, they're not good. You need to be interested in other things. So I kind of grew up with this thinking that my interests were wrong, you know, that's what he drummed into me. So I also felt, by the time I was a teenager, or even 12, 13, I just thought, well, music's never going to happen for me, I'm never going to be able to be a musician or anything, I better lower my sights, really. And then was very lucky, and I also couldn't seem to learn an instrument, not properly. I could play a few chords, that was about it. And then when I was 21, my older brother was in a working men's club band in Birmingham, and I just moved to Birmingham. And the guitar player, Steve, was leaving, but he gave him 6 months' notice. So my brother said to me, look, if you can learn all the songs in 6 months, you're in. So that was all the incentive I needed. I spent the next 6 months just learning them songs, and I was just about good enough to join the band, and I did. And once I got in that band and on the stage, you know, I just felt, this is a real start for me. This is something I can really do. And maybe I can, you know, I mean, the other guys in the band, my brother and the drummer, they were just kind of like, it was a couple of drinks at the weekend and a few quid. But for me, it was like, no, this is something. And, you know, from there, I started to write songs, and, you know, then I eventually formed my own band.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about the coming together of Dexys, because you talk about it in the book, if you'll pardon the pun, as something that was almost preordained for you. It was something that was going to happen.
I suppose so, yeah. I don't know what it was, but we, you know, after, like, we'd been in this punk band, The Killjoys, which was, it was all right, but it was just, we just learned how not to do everything. And with the Dexys, I don't know, I just from the off had the confidence, okay, this is going to work. And we had the idea for the band, and then went about forming it, you know, and just got everybody in and said, OK, you got to pack your job in. You got to sign on the dole. You could live on the dole in those days. And rehearse 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, just like a job. And we knew we wanted a brass section. We had an idea for the look. And we just said, this is what we're going to do. We didn't ask them, what's your opinion? What kind of music you want to do? We said, this is the music we're going to do. This is the style we're going to pursue. Do you want to join? Are you in? And that's how we did it. And we did have that belief. I certainly did. That, you know, if we did all the right things would happen. And they kind of did. Like, we rehearsed for about 8 months. And then, whereas in the previous Killjoys, everything seemed to be out of reach. We were always struggling to get a manager or a record company. As soon as we started doing gigs with Dexys, people just came to us. The energy has shifted completely.
You, You talk a lot about the look of the band in the early days and how important that was, and as the band goes along as well. Where did that look come from?
Like the first look, the New York Docker thing?
Yeah.
That one? I mean, we were just rehearsing one day, and it was one of them freezing cold days, and you could sort of see your own breath. And Jim had a hat on, like a woolly hat, because he, you know, he was just cold. And he looked great, you know, playing his trombone. And I just thought, okay, that's a look. And we just expanded on it. And I remembered there was a similar look from my teens, you know, from when I was about 16. So we just kind of put all that together and, you know, that was it.
Did you enjoy, you know, being in smash hits and all that kind of thing?
Yeah, I did initially. I loved it. But after a while, you know, after Eileen and that whole Touraillet thing, I'd done so much touring, and I also felt that, you know, I mean, not to compare us, I'm not comparing myself with Roxy Music, but what I liked about Roxy Music, they were commercial, but the albums had depth as well, and I wanted that, you know. So with after all that Touraillet period, which was a lot of it felt like kind of pop success, we wanted to do something deeper, and that's why we, you know, we went about making Don't Stand Me Down, and, you know, tried to take a different approach with that. You know, wanted to kind of present it in the way bands in the 70s had, like Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd, in that they just did an album. They didn't really do singles. It was all about the album, and I wanted to do that, you know.
The aftermath of that kind of early 80s Dexys bubble, if that's what you want to call it, the aftermath of that was pretty tough.
Well, you mean the addiction and all that stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was. I mean, first of all, I mean, like, all of the big money sort of came in probably 83, 84, and by 85, the manager resigned, and, like, a lot of money had come in, and the manager said, I'm resigning. And he said, the good news is you've got 40 grand in your account. And a hell of a lot more had gone through it, obviously. And he said, the bad news is you've got a tax bill for 80 grand. So, and then all these bills started arriving from everywhere. And then not long after that, I got addicted to cocaine and, you know, made bankrupt and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, there's a lot that happens in those intervening decades that maybe for those people who know the music and they know the band and they know a little bit about about what's going on with you now, but those bits, they don't really know an awful lot about that, and it's something you talk about quite candidly in the book.
Yeah, I didn't want to edit my own life. You know, I decided to put everything in, and I've just gone into detail in that. You know, I've talked about the good times, and there were plenty. You know, and I've also talked about the fact that sometimes I feel bad that I wasn't able to enjoy it more, you know. Or the decisions that I made, some of the decisions I made were, you know, wrong. But, I wanted to go right in there with the addiction and what happened and how I felt, and I wanted to portray that properly. So I used to, when I was writing it, I'd write it and then I'd leave it a while and I'd come back to it to make sure it came over, you know, exactly how I was feeling, and eventually we got it down, you know.
By the end of the book, you suggest that you're enjoying music now in a way that you never really did before, that you've kind of let yourself enjoy it in a sense, that you kind of got out of your own way.
I definitely have, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I still have anxiety, like when we did Glastonbury last year. I talk about that in the book, but I am enjoying it more definitely now. I'm more at peace with myself now, which means I can enjoy music more. And, you know, I mean, I always get really nervous. I was nervous when the book was coming out. I'll be nervous when another album is coming out, I'm sure. I always am. But, you know, generally I just, you know, I'm more at peace these days. So I think that makes me able to experience things, be present more and enjoy things more, you know.
And for somebody who has been dealing with that sort of anxiety, and people may have seen you do Glastonbury in 2024, what was that like? What was the run-up to that like for you personally?
Well, the run-up was scary, you know what I mean? I was just like, I just wanted it to be, as soon as it was confirmed, I was like, oh my God, it's going to be live television. Everybody I know will be watching it, and a whole load of other people. It was just, I couldn't get that thought out of my head. And what if I screw up? What if this happens? What if my voice doesn't work well? What if I sing bum notes? What if I drop the mic? It was all that kind of thing. But when the day came, the morning of, I was like relieved when I woke up and thought, okay, finally I can do something about it today. So I got up and I did some kind of exercises, stretches, calmed myself down, did some meditation before the show. And I was nervous before the show. I was panicking. I couldn't even find the stage. I was, the tour manager went ahead to get everything sorted out. And I just thought, oh God, we're on in a few minutes. Where's the stage? I didn't even know where it was. And I was just getting right. And then when we got on, I was okay, you know. And thank God it went well. It went really well.
Do you have any perspective on, you know, your place, your significance in pop music of the kind of, you know, the late 70s and early 80s and through the mid 80s? Did you ever look back and kind of go, oh, yeah, that was my place?
No, not really, because I'm always into what I'm doing now. You know, I'm into the book. I'm into I'm recording a new album now, Dexy's album, with David Holmes producing it. And I'm really into that. But I am grateful for the past. Like I talk about in the book, I think there were certain decisions we made. You know, I think we'd have been bigger if we'd, you know, made alternative decisions. But I am grateful for everything that happened. And the book has helped me in that way, because some of the things that bothered me that I write about in the book, you know, now that that's all kind of out there, I've said it and it's all out there, I've kind of let go of it to a large extent.
And how's the new album been going? Because it is a new album of Dexy's music, and as you said, David Holmes is producing it. So what's that been like?
It's been great, you know, working with him. I mean, he's out there. He's like a mad professor, and you know. But he's brilliant, you know, and he believes in it so much. He's phoning me all the time going, Kevin, this song. It's just like that. It's just great, you know. And he gets it. He's really got inside all of the songs. He's got inside all of the lyrics, you know, and he's talking to me about the track listing. We're nearly finished now. He believes in it so much, you know, it's great.
And when can we expect to hear that?
Next year. I'm not sure what month, but next year for sure.
Fantastic. Kevin Rowland, it's been lovely to talk to you tonight on Arena. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bless Me Father, Kevin Rowland's memoir, is published by Ebury Spotlight. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. In your evening. That was soprano Celine Byrne with the National Symphony Orchestra performing Un Bel Di from Puccini's Madama Butterfly. The opera tells the story of a young Japanese geisha who waits in vain for the return of her American naval officer husband. It's a timeless tragedy with soaring and beautiful music that resonates with audiences around the world. Though in recent times, questions of cultural stereotypes have been raised about the narrative and themes of the piece. Irish National Opera, in conjunction with Scottish Opera, is about to embark on a new highly anticipated production, which will premiere at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre next month. And I'm delighted to be joined by director Daisy Evans and bassist John Malloy, who takes on the pivotal role of the Bonds, Butterfly's disapproving uncle. Daisy, remind people who might not know of the story of Madama Butterfly. Maybe give us some sense as well as to why you think it has endured such a favourite.
Well, it's a profoundly human tragedy, and it's very, very truthful in its portrayal of the central female character. It's about this young girl who believes she's going to marry the love of her life, who will look after her forever. And she completely falls head over heels with this man that she meets on her wedding day. And they spend a couple of months together, and then he tells her that he has to go home to America. And he goes home to America and he never comes back. And he leaves her pregnant. And we come back after the interval. The first half is the wedding and the falling in love, and after the interval, we're 3 years later, and she still believes he's going to come back, even though everybody around her is telling her he's never going to come back. You've got to give up hope. And she says, no, no, no. And then she sees his ship pull into harbour one day, and he has returned. But he has, in fact, returned for his son and not for her. And so she gives over the boy and takes her own life.
You've updated the story and given it an interesting prologue of sorts. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I wanted to find a way that we could see this woman as an incredibly powerful mother figure, that we understand Butterfly is not this young, shy girl who falls madly in love with an American, but in fact this incredibly strong woman that is desperate to leave this life. We learn through her story that she's from a dishonored family in Japan, so she's not living her best life in Japan, and she's desperate to get out to America and to make a new life for herself. So the way to do that is to marry an American, which she does, and she achieves that. She's then left with this child, and her unconditional devotion to that child means that she has to get him safe. She has to ensure his future. And in fact, she achieves that. She does tragically lose her life in the process, but I wanted to find a way that we could understand that she had succeeded, that her son grew up loved, grew up in a well-heeled household, and he got everything that she wanted him to have. So we open in the 90s in a quiet funeral in America, and it's the funeral of Pinkerton, and we see Kate Pinkerton, who here is played by Imelda Drumm, and an older man who is her son, who's played by Michael Mullen, an actor. And she, Kate, brings a box of possessions to her son and lifts the lid, and out of this box pour authentic Japanese objects, kimonos, fans, all these beautiful things that then knit together and tell this boy what his history is.
John, The Bonds is a relatively brief but a kind of dramatically powerful role. How do you approach creating such an impactful character if you've got relatively limited stage time?
I think particularly on this one, Daisy and I were talking about the human elements of him. It's very, very easy to see him as an operatic cartoon who's loud and angry and comes in and screams at Butterfly. But I think the human side of the man is he's a man who's desperately trying to hold on to tradition and his traditions and his cultures and his ways. And he sees them being taken away. And he arrives into Butterfly's wedding saying exactly that. And I think also what he does is, because all of Butterfly's relations and her friends are at this wedding, and he sort of offers them an ultimatum, you know, come with me and hang on to what we have here in our cultures and our traditions, or go and continue with this, you know, go and see how you get on with this American and what life might be, because these girls think that marriage to an American officer means a better life for them, which of course we find out it doesn't necessarily so.
Puccini's score is beautiful. It has real dramatic weight, though, as well, at the same time. As a bass, I'm wondering, how does that singing of the Bonds, how does that feel? How does that fit within your voice?
Puccini didn't write a whole pile for bass. Turandot has a beautiful character, the father, Timur. In this, he writes him to come in to make noise. Bear in mind, the Bonds begins his singing off stage in the Bord Gáis, that's quite a distance from the audience, and has him off stage with the tam tam, which is a crash, big massive cymbal. He writes it fast, he writes it loud, and he writes it incredibly high within a bass's register. I'm at the absolute extremes when we curse her at the end. When things he doesn't get his way, and he puts a curse, and he says that he renounces her, and he renounces her with the family. He gets the family on side, and leaves Butterfly a mess on her wedding day.
It's quite an emotional moment, and it's quite a dramatic moment, and you get to make quite an enormous bang, and then leave the stage. Yeah. What's that like for you in terms of as an actor? How do you feel about getting to do that and then just simply exit stage?
It's absolutely terrifying because there's nowhere to redeem. I mean, it's you get one shot. You know, we don't get to do this a second time. I mean, it probably amounts to maybe 3 minutes of stage time. So there's a pressure to that in itself. I mean, you can have, you know, if you've an opportunity to redeem, that's something. But that and plus the fact he writes it so dramatically, to not be prepared for that, to, you know, because you're going from a dressing room upstairs in the Bord Gáis Theatre to on the stage in front of 2,500 people. And if the voice isn't warmed up, if the sentiment isn't worked out and isn't, if you're not present into what's going on, it can be incredibly dangerous. To, you know, anybody who stays screaming for a very long time with no knowledge will come out the worst of it.
Yeah, Daisy, the story itself has faced criticism in recent decades due to the portrayal of cultural stereotypes. Talk to me a little bit about addressing that or recontextualizing those issues for a more modern audience.
Yeah, I think the problem has come through trying to display this story too literally. So my approach is to kind of tackle it head on and say, actually, this is a Western perspective. This is about how we as Westerners view Japan. And it allows us, through this memory space, this liminal emotional space that we're creating, means that we can have more inspired costumes, that the idea being that this boy who's discovering his history is taking the faces and the textures and the fabrics that he knows that we see at the funeral, so the kind of 1990s suiting fabrics, the faces of the chorus, and kind of sticks them onto the people that populate his memory. So nothing is authentic in ours. We're not trying to appropriate anything. We are making a dream alongside Puccini's incredible music.
Talk to me about that music as well, because the score itself is something that is widely known with people outside of opera, for people who've maybe never been to an opera. So how do you ensure that your staging and your action, they complement the music without overwhelming it, particularly during maybe some of the more famous moments in the score?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most incredible scores, and it's so dramatic. And at times I feel Puccini is very self-consciously sentimental, because I find that in Act One, the music's too Hollywood. It's too much. It's almost too overwhelming. And I think that's because he wants us to feel overwhelmed. He wants us to feel that this life with Pinkerton is unattainable. We can't live like that. It's not reality. And then when you come back in Act Two and Act Three, the music's much, much more delicate. It's raw. It's vulnerable, and it's much more truthful. And I think it's just real mastery how that's kind of managed throughout the piece. And as a director, you know, I want to create a space that music can be really heard and listened to and digested in a way that we're not overwhelming with too much on the set. Everything in the set, which is this incredible kind of moving piece of origami, it kind of breathes with the music and with the singers on stage. It moves depending on the emotional spaces that we need. So it's just about complementing and supporting and not putting too much in the way.
Okay, let's have a listen to some of that now. And that's the humming chorus from Madama Butterfly. John, this isn't the only project you have on the go for INO, though, at the moment. You're preparing for The Bartered Bride as well. Yes. What are you doing in that?
I'm playing The Marriage Broker in that, Ketzel, The Marriage Broker. And we started rehearsals, we started properly today. We did 2 days of music on that. And we're travelling around the country with it.
Okay. Daisy, I'm interested just maybe to finish why you think that Madama Butterfly and maybe this particular production might be a good entry point for newcomers who've maybe never been to an opera before.
I think the drama and the emotion is so immediate and so direct, and the story is kind of incredibly complex but also incredibly simple, and it's so moving. And Butterfly is such a beautiful heroine. She's so innocent, so vulnerable, but so strong and powerful that I just think she can't fail but enrapture you.
Well, director Daisy Evans, baritone John Molloy, it has been a joy talking to both of you tonight on Arena. Thanks so much for joining us. Best of luck with the production. The Irish National Opera Madama Butterfly is at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre from the 2nd to the 8th of November, and you'll find more ticket details at boardgaishenergytheatre.ie. Just to finish up tonight's programme, the shortlist has been unveiled for the Unpost Irish Book Awards 2025. You'll never be able to find all of them online. There are far too many of them for us to go through all of them between now and the end of the programme. But Cecilia Ahern, Donald Ryan, Brenda Fricker, John Banville, Miriam O'Callaghan and former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar are amongst the authors on the shortlist for the awards, which take place in November. It is the 20th year of the Irish Book Awards, and winners will be announced at an awards ceremony in the Convention Centre, Dublin, on Thursday the 27th of November. As usual, you'll find a special TV programme hosted by Oliver Callan announcing the overall Irish Book of the Year, and that's going to be broadcast on RTE1 on Thursday the 11th of December, and I can guarantee you're going to hear an awful lot more about that between here and there. And that is it for tonight's Arena, produced by Sinead Egan. Paula Shields was our researcher. Broadcast coordinator tonight was Ollie Hamilton, and sound supervision by Tom Norton. I'm Rick O'Shea, and I will talk to you again tomorrow night at the usual time of 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. After news tonight, on the way is John Creedon. Have yourself a safe and wonderful evening, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.